We'll go back to the US. We are going to speak to Whitney Webb, who is going to talk to us about Moderna. Whitney, tut uns leid, dass sie so lange warten musste und ich muss mich dauernd entschuldigen, irgendwie.
Time limits, because most of the people who we interview are have such interesting stories to tell. Same with the journalist who we just spoke with. He is telling, or he told us about how this is all going. He's an economist. How this is all going to end in a giant crash, and how we will have to make sure that this time it's the other side that's going to have to pay, and not us.
Right. I hope that's what happens.
Yeah, it's up to us, but we'll make sure this happens through what you're telling us, through what this journalist just told us, and what everybody else is telling us, because it all points in the same direction. We do have to change course. We have to take our sovereignty back, and we have to hold those who are responsible for this legally responsible.
Yeah, I couldn't agree. More with what you just said.
All right, great. Yeah, go ahead. You wanted to tell us, give us some more insights into Moderna, I think.
Sure. So I'm doing an investigative series right now on Moderna. The third part is not out yet, but hopefully soon it will be. The first part came out earlier this month. The second part just a couple days ago. Mm-hmm. So essentially, the reason I started looking into Moderna, I guess this late in the game, because obviously they've been essentially a household name since the whole COVID-19 crisis began, was because I stumbled upon several articles from U.S. mainstream media dating back to 2016, talking about how, quoting former Moderna employees as saying that Moderna was basically a fraud, sort of in the style of Theranos, if you're familiar with that.
Yes. Yes.
That it was sort of essentially Emperor's New Clothes was the idiom used to describe it by some employees. But essentially, they described Moderna as an investment firm that hoped that maybe their drug technology would eventually produce something. And of course, that wasn't actually the case, because by the time this critical reporting emerged in 2016, Moderna had been around for 6 years and had no product to market. And that was still the case in January 2020 as well. But what's interesting is that, as I point out in part one of my series, all the different factors that Moderna was facing that were pushing them essentially to collapse. And as recently as this week, Moderna executives, including their president, have admitted that at the tail end, the end of 2019 and beginning of 2020, the company had reached the end of the line financially and was cutting everything down and was essentially facing a complete financial collapse, which is quite significant because you have a very desperate entity at that point, trying to prevent what was then the largely most, highly valued biotech company at the time of its IPO, essentially having been built on a house of cards, which is quite significant in and of itself. But beyond that, you have the fact that COVID-19 removes all of the multifaceted problems that Moderna faced in many different realms of its business. And that doesn't just include the regulatory hurdles they could never pass, but also financial issues and long-standing patent disputes. And over the course of 2020, well, first of all, the way their COVID-19 vaccine partnership emerged with the NIH is very suspect, in the sense that the people most responsible for it, which is Moderna's CEO, Stéphane Bancel, and the head of the NIH's VRC, Barney Graham, they said some interesting things about why they actually started developing the vaccine before the sequence of the virus was even published by Chinese authorities on January 11th. 2020, they apparently had begun that at least 2 days prior. Barney Graham having said, he visited Moderna's facilities in November 2019. A month later, he sent an email to the head of the coronavirus team at the NIH, VRC, where he works, saying, get ready for a big 2020, essentially, when no one else had any way of knowing that there would be a coronavirus involved at that point of time.
What was that? That was in January of 2020?
No, that was December 2019 when he sent that email.
Very interesting. Yeah,
there's a lot more to that in the second part. I detail all of that. What's odd though is that this partnership officially formed. They say that Bonsell emailed Graham either the January 6th or January 7th, somewhere in that ballpark. But they've given different interviews talking about how their great foresight and how serendipitous their partnership was and all of this to various mainstream media outlets over the past year and a half. And their story changes every time in slight details, which suggests that they aren't exactly working from an honest story, since they seem to change considerable details. At that point, before the sequence was even released, Bonsell is allegedly troubled by the reports of an outbreak in China. And Graham says, well, I don't know what it is, but if it's a coronavirus, we're ready. I believe it was a day before the sequence came out, Graham met with the head of Moderna's vaccine program and essentially said, wouldn't it be cool if you guys started diverting a lot of time, attention, and energy into just seeing how fast you could develop a vaccine for this thing and that's happening in Wuhan once the virus comes out? Wouldn't that be a cool thing to do? And per the official story, Moderna's like, yeah, let's do it. And that's why they claim they were ready, had already started this like 1 to 2 days before the sequence had even come out. But that doesn't really make a lot of sense when you consider what has been admitted now, that the company was financially falling apart and the fact that their few remaining investors were completely opposed to the coronavirus vaccine program until like March or April of 2020. So if they're facing collapse, why would they risk alienating their remaining investors and essentially bet their entire company on a vaccine program no one knows they need? It doesn't really make a lot of sense. And then you also have the added account of Bonsell's visit to the World Economic Forum towards the end of January 2020, where he goes on to claim that upon his first day there, he speaks with two unnamed European infectious disease researchers who convince him that this is a biblical plague that will, obliterate everything as we know it, basically, and that he needed to develop this vaccine for that reason, and then begins diverting even more resources, I guess you could say, and money into that particular program. And this is, of course, before there was really even any talk, at least in the public, of what COVID-19 would eventually become. And mainstream media in the U.S. has essentially boiled this down to foresight and serendipity. But there's a lot of oddities. I've mentioned a few. But there's more in the article. Another example is that Barty.
When was this meeting at the World Economic Forum?
The 21st of January is when he claimed to have learned that it will be this biblical plague.
This is while everyone, all the politicians, all the mainstream media, everyone kept telling the public, this is nothing to worry about. We don't need to take any special measures. No masks, no nothing. And this is also about the same time that Drosten started to work on his, while he was telling the public, don't worry about a thing, started to work on his PCR test.
Oh,
very
interesting.
Strange. Well, very strange.
Yeah, it all seems to line up.
Yes.
Actually, quite well. But it seems that shortly after that, BioNTech, Sahin, this the BioNTech boss, had also a miraculous insight into seeing what's coming up in Wuhan and immediately thinking, oh, this is going to be like a global pandemic. And then one day he seems to have looked into the newspaper and then the same day developed 10 candidates for the new vaccine, although he's never done that before.
That's also
strange.
Serendipitous, I guess.
Serendipitous and his foresight. It's just like, did you know that BioNTech never, just like Moderna, had never been able to put together any product yet, And they were, I should say, in the same dire straits as Moderna was, yet Bill Gates, through either Gavi or the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, I don't know, invested $53 or $58 million in that company in, I think, September of 2019, Foresight.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out that Moderna is also a strategic ally of the Gates Foundation, but their partnership, I believe, goes back to 2016.
And
Moderna has also been partnered with the World Economic Forum, which I mentioned a bit ago, since 2013, which they're one of their global growth companies, which has given them, per the description of what that means, exclusive access to a special messaging platform to talk to privileged business and public sector leaders since then. So that's interesting. But anyway, going back to the origin story here, one other thing that does stand out that I should mention is that before the sequence was out, the NIH's Barney Graham said, if it's a coronavirus, we know that mRNA has been proven effective. His claim, purported confidence in the efficacy of mRNA at that point was actually based on some very preliminary but positive data that have come out about a Moderna candidate in September 2019, but for the CMV virus. And that, of course, is in the family of like herpes, shingles, chickenpox, not coronavirus. So there's really no way that that data can be extrapolated to say, oh, we know that mRNA will be effective in a coronavirus vaccine. What's worth noting as well is that Barney Graham and his team at the NIH developed a patent in 2017 for the pre-fusion version of a coronavirus spike protein that's currently not just in use in the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine, but in most, I believe, of the COVID-19 vaccines currently in use or that are about to go to market, including CureVac. I believe Johnson & Johnson also uses it in the Novavax one as well. And before COVID-19, as I'm sure you all are familiar with, there was a lot of the belief that there would be the development of a coronavirus vaccine at any point in time was sort of a pipe dream, because since the SARS incident, I guess, in 2003-2004, scientists around the world have been trying to develop a coronavirus vaccine without success for a variety of reasons. And so that patent could not be capitalized, could not be commercialized unless there was, a coronavirus vaccine developed at some point. So it's interesting that Barney Graham keeps talking about coronaviruses in the lead up to the release of the sequence before anyone could have known it was a coronavirus. And he just happens to have a patent for that specifically. Some doctors, like Dr. Michael Palmer and Dr. Bhakti, who I know you've had on, have pointed out, why didn't they use a toxoid, as they call it, instead of, the spike protein itself? Well, that would have also meant not using the Barney Graham patent, which is worth noting. Mm-hmm. If they had not used the spike protein as it's used in these vaccines, they would not have needed to commercialize that a particular patent that, these people were very interested in commercializing. And actually, NIH documents before COVID-19 were described by NYU law experts as being unusually prescient about the importance of Barney Graham's patents in terms of commercialization at a time when there was really no reason to believe that, at least publicly.
This coincides, by the way, with what Dr. David Martin told us, that there were dozens and dozens of patents that they had filed for many, many years, like 17 years before the actual corona pandemic, both patents on the coronavirus, including the spike protein, and patents on possible vaccines, obviously.
Well, there does seem, in terms of my research on, I haven't looked at every company in this detail, but that definitely seems to be the case with Moderna. There is a lot of things going on in terms of patents. What's interesting specifically about Moderna and the patent issue is that they license They have an issue with a company called Arbutus Biopharma, and that technology, which is the lipid nanoparticle delivery system technology, essentially is also in use in the BioNTech Pfizer vaccine, but BioNTech has a license for it. Moderna's license has been the subject of a lot of controversy because they didn't license it from Arbutus directly. They licensed it through a company that had a sub-license, and it's been a long-standing patent dispute ever since. And what's interesting is that Moderna, in 2017, had to pivot away from what they had originally told their investors they were going to develop, these novel mRNA therapies to vaccines. They did that because they realized using that technology, they could not develop multi-dose therapies because they kept being too toxic to make it to human trials. They were too toxic in animal trials repeatedly. So they made the pivot to vaccines because that requires one dose, not multi-dose. So this technology, they weren't allowed to, they realized they couldn't really take anything to market using it that would require more than one dose. And that was why they ended up pivoting to vaccines. And that's also at the same point, they partnered up with the NIH, both with Barty Graham and Anthony Fauci, to start developing vaccines with the U.S. government. And before then, it's worth pointing out that Moderna, as well as longstanding ties to the U.S. military's DARPA, that precede that partnership with the NIH by several years. but anyway, this particular lipid nanoparticle situation, it appears that same technology, despite Moderna coming out and saying it's not very good, it's bad, and we're not using it anymore because of the controversy that happened then in 2017, are in fact using it in their COVID-19 vaccine, which is also discussed in part two of my series that's now available. And I can go into that if you'd like.
From what product did they pivot to the vaccines? What was the first product?
Well, it was a failed product. It was to treat, I believe it's pronounced Crigler-Najjar syndrome, or N-A-J-J-A-R. Not exactly sure of the pronunciation there. Mm-hmm. Sorry, because I've only seen it written personally. But it was considered the lowest hanging fruit for Moderna to develop an mRNA multi-dose therapy of sorts, they couldn't do it. And they had to indefinitely delay it. They had partnered to do that with Alexion Pharmaceuticals, which cut off the partnership with them. And they essentially had to shelve it indefinitely. It's still shelved.
And the Moderna vaccine is like two doses as well, isn't it? So then the toxic aspect here going on as well.
So after 2017, they sort of expanded this to be like, oh, well, vaccines can be one or two doses, but it was really anything beyond that that they declined to focus on because of this persistent issue with toxicity in trials. Mm-hmm. So essentially that would apply to anything that becomes, for example, an annual booster dose. If it does in fact rely on this technology, which the evidence certainly points in that direction. And as I mentioned, BioNTech has
licensed. Well, that's what's going on right now, because in Australia, we're going to show a clip at the end of our session today of some government official who officially announces from now on, it's going to be a booster shot every 6 months.
Yeah, well, Chile has announced that as well. Mm.
Let's see how many people will play along with that one then. Because it effectively tells you, in effect, it tells you that the vaccines don't work. Because if a vaccine's effectiveness wanes after 6 months, you begin to question the whole thing, the whole strategy that they're driving here.
Well, for some people, so in the case of Chile, where they've already announced the vaccine passport will expire for people over 55 that don't get a third dose. They're working on a fourth dose, and it will be at least an annual affair, most likely a semi-annual affair. There's really very little pushback about that here, which is unfortunate. But I think a lot of it has to do with the media situation in Chile, every single channel is in complete lockstep about the entire narrative, including the vaccination narrative. The weather, despite the fact that cases are growing as more and more people become vaccinated, is being treated as a, you know, the pandemic of the unvaccinated narrative. But this, of course, what they're doing here, like they changed the definition for herd immunity and vaccine. If you change the definition of what fully vaccinated means, then you can treat people that have had two doses of the vaccine as unvaccinated. And, you know, if they're responsible for the increase in cases, you can then go, aha, the pandemic of the unvaccinated, even though that should technically, to most people, it would mean people with no doses, right? So, I mean, it's just, they're sort of creating the situation they need to maintain that narrative, it seems.
It's a gigantic hoax. I was just looking at a picture here, which says, for the first time in history, a medicine's ineffectiveness is now being blamed on those who haven't taken it. It's so bizarre. It's so bizarre.
Yeah, that's a very succinct way of putting it. Yes, it's wild. So one thing I do want to bring up with Moderna, though, that I was sort of touching on with this patent dispute, is that basically because of this, it appears... Let me back up a little bit. Basically, Moderna's chief corporate affairs officer made a claim last year that's quite astounding, or at least I found it to be astounding. essentially, he said that the NIH, the trials they were conducting for the Moderna vaccine last year, and you know, the data of this came out, you know, press releases, lots of positive press for Moderna, their stock price would surge. This Moderna executive claimed that those studies were not using the commercial candidate for the vaccine, that they were applying for emergency use authorization. They were using a different formula for those studies and then touting the data of that publicly. But really it was a different candidate that they were seeking to have approved. And that's from a Moderna executive himself.
Absolutely, that's grotesque.
It's absurd. It doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make sense, but I think essentially they've done it because of this patent dispute. Uh-huh. Because they're either using the old lipid nanoparticle technology they say they're not using. Mm-hmm. And when he was challenged on that point, that look at all these indicators that you are in fact using it, he made that claim. But, you know, it really only opens up two possibilities. He's either lying, and that's the case, mm-hmm. Or he's telling the truth. And the NIH used something entirely different in co-developing and developing this vaccine with Moderna that wasn't the same formulation as what was eventually approved under emergency use authorization, which is totally scandalous. Someone has mentioned to me that it appears that BioNTech did something similar, yeah. At least based on what the EMA has said. But I haven't looked into that personally, but I hope someone does, because if so, that's just totally insane. Considering the fact that both of those companies, Moderna and BioNTech, could not take a product to market previously, and it was really only the unique regulatory, and you could also argue media environment that emerged as a result of COVID-19 was the only way that these could get through any sort of regulatory approval.
It seems, I think this is what I remember from David Martin's presentation here. It seems that this may have had a lot to do with the fact that the patents for the lipids were held by a Canadian corporation and they couldn't get to it.
I believe that's Arbutus Biopharma.
That's
I believe
what it is.
I think that's Aquitas. Mm-hmm. I'll have to look that up. But that was the company that sublicensed it to Moderna. Mm-hmm. They may be based in Canada, but Arbutus, I believe, is now based in Pennsylvania, but I don't know if that was true at the time. I'd have to look more into that specifically. It looks like the original company Moderna had licensed it from was Canadian, but yeah. They're not the source of that mm-hmm. Patent necessarily. They have a sub-license to it because someone that worked for Arbutus later went off and created this Aquitas company in uh-huh. Canada.
What is going on now with them financially? Because there's all these stories coming out that more and more countries are banning Moderna's vaccine. Because of serious side effects.
Right. And you would think as a result of that, market analysts would reduce what they expect Moderna to make in COVID-19 sales.
Yeah.
Earlier this year, prospects for 2022 sales of Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine was $1 billion. But this week, they're now projected to be $35 billion. That is quite a jump. Why did that happen? I don't know, but I think some of it has to do with something I'll be exploring in part three, which has to do with this particular company that Moderna has partnered with for manufacturing. So they're partnered with manufacturing in Europe with a company.
Hier ist sie noch. Da ist sie eingefroren.
We can't hear you right now.
Hello.
Hello.
Back.
Okay, you're back.
Hello.
Sorry.
Am I back? Sorry yes. about that. Okay, so last May, Moderna teamed up with a company called Lonza in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And that was a 10-year agreement, essentially focused on their COVID-19 vaccine. So that's manufacturing COVID-19 vaccines in Europe by Moderna for at least 10 years. And that's before there was even any data on the efficacy or put out in the public sphere or safety of that vaccine. But more recently, just a couple months ago, they teamed up with a company in North America that is very interesting because they have very considerable ties to the CIA. Not only do they have a CIA, the head of NQTEL, the CIA's venture capital arm on their board, they have Scott Gottlieb, who's also on the former FDA commissioner, who's on mainstream U.S. news quite a bit, is on the board of Pfizer and also Illumina, the gene sequencing company that's had seen their valuation also explode during this period. The former top executive of the Gates Foundation, a former commission member of the 9/11 commission. Why is he there? That's a little odd. And then you also have people directly tied to Palantir, which if you're not familiar with them, is very much tied to the CIA since their founding, essentially a front for the CIA, I would argue. And my work on Palantir provides a lot of evidence to that point.
How do you
ones manufacturing the RNA for the Moderna COVID vaccine going forward. And it's...
She's gone.
Wow. Das ist ja ein interessanter Moment, an dem sie uns da wegfliegt. Also...
War das doch
sie erzählt gerade von einer Verbindung, Palantine heißen die.
Palantir.
Die sie so einschätzt, dass sie eine CIA-Front sind. Das war vielleicht zu hart. Aber das Problem, sehen wir gerade, liegt nicht bei uns. Wir sind, glaube ich, immer noch gut vernehmbar und auch sichtbar. Sondern das Problem liegt bei ihr. Mal gucken, ob sie zurückkommt. Also sie macht, sie geht ganz tief rein. Das hat sie ja uns jetzt beim
letzten... Oh, and she's been showing us again before. Now she goes into more detail of Moderna and in the end she's confirmed Moderna was done in early 2020 and only the fact that the coronavirus was declared a worldwide crisis pulled them out of the mud.
So it's basically the same with BioNTech. They only came into being really with all this.
Very, very, very strange. Abyss is opening here.
Well, of course, if you have a new product, if you're Roche or Pfizer, and then if you can launch a product that may be problematic, then it might be better if I have a startup for the first liability phase, maybe, rather than taking the flak myself, because you never know what will be their long-term relationship.
You mean the connection between Pfizer and BioNTech? Yeah, that makes complete sense.
And with Moderna, we don't know for sure. Ich glaube, sie ist auch wieder da.
Sind sie wieder da, Whitney?
Yeah, my power's just gone out as I was saying that. sorry about that. I'm still here. At least my internet is not based on isn't Wi-Fi, so that saved me here. Yeah. Sorry. So what I was, I don't know if you heard it, that particular company with all of those CIA ties and ties to the national security state of the U.S. more broadly is who will now be going forward developing the RNA for Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine. Mm-hmm. And it's a multi-year agreement. They have declined to publicly say how many years it's for. Mm-hmm. So, you know, national security state players in the U.S. Obviously see Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine as being something that's going to be sold regularly for multiple years to come, given their presence on that board. What's interesting about this company in general, they're called Resilience or National Resilience. They also have partnerships with like the government of Canada. They're essentially seeking to be, I guess, the manufacturer in basically doing all of the steps that Moderna had trouble with previously in getting their products taken to market. Mm-hmm. They're essentially relying, offering to manufacture all of these mRNA vaccines for them, and then, but basically just getting the code, the software code to use Moderna's favorite analogy for that type of stuff, from a company like Moderna, and then they do everything else, including some of the trials. So I don't know if you really want to trust a company with that many CIA ties to be developing injections that are increasingly being linked to your participation in society and civil liberties and things like that. I mean, it's a really wild situation.
Wasn't it Moderna's CEO who explicitly said that their product can be used to reprogram people?
I think that might have been Tal Zaks, the chief scientific officer of Moderna, but they call it hacking the software of life. This is all before COVID. But honestly, a lot of that is hype to sell investors on, I think, mm-hmm. because they couldn't get mRNA into cells basically without it being too toxic to people and causing too many adverse events, essentially. Mm-hmm.
Do you know anything about like production capacities, if they were built up like kind of in advance, or is there no hints in that direction?
So Moderna has claimed that their manufacturing ability was extremely hampered through the first half of 2020 by the fact that they had no money because of this dire financial situation they were facing. Of course, COVID-19 comes at just the right time, sort of as a miracle. To rescue them, they claim it wasn't until BARDA, which is part of HHS in the U.S. government, gave them, I think, $438 million in mid-April that they were able to really even start manufacturing anything beyond what they had sent the NIH.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow in this period of time, oh my God, I am having... Hello.
we can hear you. It's just that it seems that you're losing power.
Okay.
But we can. Okay.
Yeah. I. Like. Yes. It's still out. So. Okay. Sorry. So basically, in even though they were having all these problems, they claim that's why they had to do so much fundraising over the course of 2020, which includes these sort of insider stock sales. They got in trouble for in May, you know, right before that was allegedly so they could manufacture the COVID-19 vaccine. But right before that, they create this manufacturing agreement with Lonza, the Swiss company, and we're building up manufacturing capabilities there. And of course, their partnership with BARDA, BARDA was offering to pay for that and also connects them with manufacturers in the U.S. I don't know how true that is. I think it's more them several months after the fact, perhaps trying to offer a new reason for some of those insider stock sales and different fundraising efforts that didn't necessarily make sense at the time. And some of them were controversial, like the ones in May. that they made after this particular press release that was based off of this NIH studies where supposedly it wasn't even the commercial candidate that they were actually planning to take to market. They used that, the hype off of that. It was incomplete data at the time. I think they released data on just 8 of like 40 something volunteers to generate positive buzz around their particular vaccine candidate, even though it was based on the study of something that wasn't their actual vaccine candidate. I just find that so crazy. That definitely really needs to be looked into, because the fact that Moderna's one of their top executives made that claim is something that can definitely be poked at by people looking to take on these companies and sort of the legal realm.
That may very well take away the foundation for their EUA, because if it's based it's definitely worth taking a closer look at this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely. Well, it depends on how much they say, the FDA says that the EUA rested upon those specific NIH studies, but it seemed, at least in terms of selling it to the public, it definitely relied on that to a significant degree. So it definitely is an important takeaway from that.
Mm-hmm. Well, very interesting. All of these things are coming to light. I keep repeating this. That's the only good thing that comes out of the corona crisis, because we're beginning to see all this corruption, all these criminal activities. And it seems to pivot around these vaccine producers, whoever they really are. But it looks as though there's always somebody else pulling their strings too. In this case, in the case of Moderna, it seems the national intelligence agencies that are heavily involved in this.
It could be. I mean, you have longstanding ties with Moderna and DARPA, for example, which has a lot of DARPA also. It has a lot of ties to like Silicon Valley and different entities as well. And now you're seeing Moderna team up with InQtel and all of this stuff. And they also have a longstanding collaboration with NIH and BARDA. And at the time, by the way, that BARDA was making these awards to Moderna, you know, they're being overseen nominally by Rick Bright, but Rick Bright's boss is a man named Robert Kadlec, who I really recommend people take the time to look into. If you are familiar with the Dark Winter exercise before the anthrax attacks, the name of that simulation derives from something Robert Kadlec says at those exercises. He was intimately involved in that whole Dark Winter nexus and event, and also in what a very interesting timing with the anthrax attacks, his activities as well. But he has a very interesting track record in terms of corruption through the years, and also in essentially creating BARDA over the past 20 years through authoring different pieces of legislation. But I don't know how much you all have looked into the simulation that Robert Kadlec led at HHS about a pandemic originating in China that took place from January 2019 through August 2019. But in terms of that pandemic simulation, the name of the virus they were simulating was actually the same name as a virus candidate or vaccine candidate for a particular virus that Moderna was then developing with the NIH back in 2019.
You know what? The evidence is mounting, of course, that this is a long-held plan and a long-planned pandemic. There's evidence, we now have evidence that shows us that for at least 10 years, those who are behind this have been planning for this. But there's more evidence that shows us that starting in 2017 or so, maybe a little earlier, but in 2017, they were already producing and selling loads of COVID-19 PCR tests and loads of possible COVID-19 vaccines. We're going to have to take a closer look at this, but the evidence is mounting that this has been planned for years ahead of time. This is not a pandemic, this is a plandemic.
Well, in looking at the anthrax attack specifically, I think it's quite clear that at least within the United States, there was a plan to sort of usher in what we're now seeing with this biosecurity state. Mm-hmm. There was an effort to do this back then with the anthrax attacks, because the anthrax attacks weren't just meant to be what they ended up becoming. They were intended to, in my opinion, because I've done a lot of research on those attacks, go on for several months, maybe even years, to usher in this new age of the invisible enemy aren't just, you know, terrorists a la the war on terror and what that became, but also, you know, the invisible enemy, the virus or bioterror specifically. There was an effort, and you see this in Dark Winter, to link, you know, Al-Qaeda in Iraq to bioterrorism and blame them for anthrax. But unfortunately for them, it was tied back to a U.S. military source too quickly. And so they couldn't blame it on those external forces. But if they had succeeded in doing that, they had all of these plans ready to go, including DARPA, which I've mentioned a couple times. Their Total Information Awareness Program had an entire biosecurity component. And a lot of that has been being developed in the U.S. in the COVID-19 era by HHS. Some of these biosurveillance programs that they had developed and had planned to execute, but were canceled around 2003, 2004 or so. But a lot of those policies intended to be implemented in the wake of the anthrax attacks basically went back to the drawing board, or to the waiting room rather, and have made their reemergence as we're seeing this effort to create a biosecurity state now. But I think it's quite convincing to argue that plans by some of these powers that be to implement this biosecurity state model goes back several years. And maybe the most recent planning stages to do that with what has transpired recently may go back to 2017, but it seems like it's something that, if you look at the anthrax attacks, predates that even more.
Wow. And could you give us a little bit more background information about this Robert Catley?
I haven't written about him since last year, and I've done a lot of reports since then, but I do have a very lengthy expose on him that I would encourage people to read as part of a series I did on the anthrax attacks and their parallels to COVID called Engineering Contagion, that sort of explores some of the commonalities between the 9/11 era and the anthrax attacks and what's been happening over the past year and a half. Robert Catley, during the COVID-19 crisis, was the top, what was the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, which basically gave him control over setting the vast majority of COVID-19 policies during the Trump administration, because once Biden came to office, he no longer held that position. But essentially, when COVID began, you know, he was doing all of this after the year prior, having, as I mentioned earlier, this Crimson Contagion exercise, simulating that with at the local level, the state level, and the federal level, and with numerous private companies, you know, simulating this pandemic that originates from China, is a highly transmissible flu-like virus that spreads through air travel to other countries in the world, and things like that. It's sort of like Event 201 in that it's very closely analogous to what would happen soon after. And as I mentioned earlier, Robert Catley is the person from which the name Dark Winter is derived, from the June 2001 Dark Winter exercise that predicted major aspects and indeed the entire narrative, really, about the anthrax attacks just a few months before those took place. And at the time, between September 11th and the anthrax attacks, Robert Catley was appointed to become the top advisor to the U.S. Department of Defense about bioterror and anthrax specifically. And he has a lot of longstanding ties to very suspect individuals, including one of the individuals that I think was most likely actually responsible for the anthrax attacks. It was blamed on Bruce Ivins, but my research points to it having been a man named William Patrick III, who was a former Fourth Detrick researcher and consultant to the CIA, FBI, and was working at Battelle Memorial Institute with the former head of a CIA asset who used to head the Soviet Union's, or be the number two guy maybe in the Soviet Union's bioweapons program, who was working for this very shady CIA and Pentagon contractor called the Battelle Memorial Institute. which seems to have been a more likely origin for the anthrax than Fort Detrick, which was blamed for it later. But Robert Cadillac worked very closely with all those individuals, as well as the people who authored the Dark Winter Exercise. And it's worth pointing out that same, the main authors of that, the Johns Hopkins, it was then the Center for Civilian Biodefense Studies. That is the same Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, as it was later renamed, that did Event 201. And Thomas Inglesby was the moderator at Event 201, one of the main authors of Dark Winter, which also had a lot of ties to Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby, his chief of staff. But in that period of time between anthrax and Robert Cadillac becoming ASPR, the Assistant Secretary of Preparedness and Response, he essentially was working behind the scenes, contracting and working with some of the most corrupt pharmaceutical companies in the business, and authoring legislation that would eventually result in the creation of the ASPR office he ended up leading right when COVID-19 hit, which is very, again, serendipitous. And lucky for him, I guess you could say. But there's definitely a lot to look into that in that particular individual specifically, including his ties to a company called Emergent BioSolutions, which was named to be the manufacturer the Johnson & Johnson one for sure, but some of the other COVID-19 vaccines in the U.S. were also manufactured by Emergent BioSolutions, and they're the company, BioPort, that was behind the anthrax vaccine mandates for the U.S. military, and were also partnered up with Battelle in the lead up to the 2001 anthrax attacks, and it was actually the 2001 anthrax attacks that rescued their anthrax vaccine program, because the Pentagon in September 2001 was going to cut that company off entirely and do the anthrax vaccine program without them. And then a miracle, sort of like what happened with Moderna and COVID-19, comes onto the scene. Not a miracle for anyone else, a miracle for this company, because the part of the Pentagon that is working on how to sort of divest from this company is hit on September 11th, 2001. So that report never comes out. Donald Rumsfeld decides to give them another chance. And then the anthrax attacks happen, and all these concerns about its safety, among other things, specifically safety, because it was actually linked by some very credible people to Gulf War syndrome, among other things. They essentially calls to investigate this company are replaced with calls for more anthrax vaccine after the anthrax attacks, essentially. And Robert Cadillac is a key figure in all of that, and also Operation Warp Speed and a lot of the other things that came out of the Trump administration's response to COVID-19.
So which company's documents were destroyed in this, or the report on these the shenanigans that were going on, like in the attack?
Was it Emergent BioSolutions?
They're called Emergent BioSolutions today, but they've only been called that since 2004. Before that, they were known as BioPort, and they're sort of a combination of the port in BioPort is for porting down, sort of the part of, I guess, the Fort Detrick equivalent of the UK that was spun off and privatized. It's a very interesting company to look into. I can forward you that those articles I did on them, but that was last year. But essentially, it was the Pentagon was working on a plan to how to carry their anthrax vaccine program forward without this company, even though they were the only anthrax vaccine producer in the United States at the time. And so the report, the plan, the people writing that report and developing that plan, their infrastructure in terms of like computers and stuff were hit on 9/11.
Wow, that's
very convenient. It's a miracle.
Amazing connections.
Yeah. We'll have to take deeper looks into all of this, but we will very soon be talking to someone who participated in this exercise, this Dark Winter exercise, and we're really very much looking forward to talking to this man.
All right. That'll be interesting to see. Can I ask who it is?
Sure. what's his name? Corvin knows it. Corvin, can you write it down? Jim something.
It's a B.
Yeah, I was going to say Jim Bailey, but that's not his name.
He was already, like, at some point he wanted to be on the show already,
yeah.
But then he had
yeah.
some...
It's either next Friday or the Friday after that. He'll be on one of our sessions.
I have one last question.
I'll look for that. Thank you. Oh,
mm-hmm. What's the business aspect that Moderna and InQtel are working on together?
It's a manufacturing agreement Moderna has made to produce its RNA for its mRNA vaccine for COVID-19 with a company called Resilience. And on the board of that company is the CEO, the head of InQtel, Chris Darby. But in addition to that, the InQtel is very directly tied to the CIA. You also have Palantir people on the board and ties to Palantir co-founders. And one of the main funders of this company is Joe Lonsdale, Palantir co-founders, a venture capital firm. And Palantir was essentially created by the CIA with the cooperation of Peter Thiel. That's really where that company comes from. I can go into more detail about that maybe another time, because I know that you have another guest waiting.
Did you say it was the cooperation of Peter Thiel?
Palantir was nominally created by Peter Thiel, Alex Karp, Joe Lonsdale, and I think one other guy. Mm-hmm. But it was with InQtel funding, and the CIA guided their product development and was their first client for their first and only client for their first 6 years as a company. Mm-hmm. And oddly enough, the CIA point man in developing Palantir's product was a man named Alan Wade, who had developed Homeland Security software with Robert Maxwell's daughter and Ghislaine Maxwell's sister, Christine Maxwell, in the years prior to that, which is just a fun fact for your audience. Little weird. But Palantir is something very closely tied to the U.S. national security state. Their software is currently used by every single U.S. intelligence agency, many corporations, but really the entire U.S. national security state uses it. And they've also been placed at the center of harvesting COVID-19 data, both in the U.S. and the United Kingdom.
Okay. Well, Whitney, it was a pleasure. We learned
a
lot.
I'm sorry about my power issues.
Don't worry about it. This has not really distracted our attention from what you're saying. It was just a brief pause, but we're fine. That's cool.
Okay.
Well, Whitney, thank you very much again.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Absolutely. My pleasure. Take care.
Take care. See you later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.